For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week, 91-year-old author Hilma Wulitzer introduces us to her new collection of short stories, Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. Sir Derek Jacobi reflects on his long and distinguished career and reveals some studio secrets about his work as a narrator. And Robert Kingjet reveals how and why he set out to compile a collection of short stories written by blind authors. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Today, A Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket is the title story in a collection of short stories by 91-year-old author Hilma Wulitzer. The collection includes stories first published in magazines in the 1960s and 70s, when Wulitzer was hailed as the voice of her generation of women, and they bring us right up to date with a new story written in the wake of her husband's death from COVID last year. Together, they present a witty and poignant reflection on the beauty and banality of everyday life. Hilma joined me from her home in New York. Hilma, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much, Red.
Most of the stories in the collection were written in the 1960s and 70s, but remain as fresh and as pertinent today as they were then. How was it for you, looking back across half a century at what you'd written?
Well, I hadn't read them during all this time, but I had to reread them to put them into the collection and give them some order. And it was surprising to me that they still seem true to me today, even though there were certain things like there were no cell phones and there were no computers in the stories. And to my horror, the women in the stories don't seem to have any jobs or careers other than being housewives. But I felt that their inner lives were still valid. And I was very pleased that when the first people at the publisher read them, they were young women and they related to them and did find them relevant. So that was extremely pleasing.
That is something that is expressed by novelist Elizabeth Strout in the foreword to this collection, that you have a wonderful way of capturing those moments of extraordinary clarity amid the fog of domestic work, bringing up a child and having to do the shopping and everything, where your character sees their way forward. And Elizabeth Strout has very much inherited your way of writing that kind of insightful domestic fiction.
Well, that's a compliment because I admire her so much. I think that it has to do with observation and curiosity. And also domestic life itself was actually interesting in some ways. I realized after a while that I was restless and wanted something else, something more, which turned out to be writing. But there were so many correlations between what I did as a housewife and what I did as a writer. I could make an analogy between cleaning a closet and revising a story, you know, getting rid of all those bent metal hangers and clothes that you weren't going to wear anymore. And you saw within the story things that no longer belonged, and the story became fresher and cleaner and truer.
Nine of the stories follow a couple called Howard and Paulette, from their shotgun wedding through marital strife and depression, and bring us right up to date. Can you introduce us to Howard and Paulie and give us an idea of where they came from?
Well, they did come from the imagination. They're not based on anyone I know. I feel very strongly about protecting people's privacy, my own, my family's, and my friends. And it's more fun to imagine people. They did have parallel lives to ours in that they got married young and had children and had the usual joys and struggles of married life. And so I felt as if I knew them, as if they were friends. And writing about them again and again was out of curiosity as to what happened to them. And then I didn't write about them for many years. I didn't write any fiction, actually, or certainly any short stories for a number of years. And then after my husband and I had COVID, I felt it was very important to put that down. But as a fiction writer, I didn't want to write it directly from our own experience. I used aspects of our own experience in the story, but I also put in invented details, and I assigned the whole thing to these fictional characters, these old fictional friends, Paulette and Howard.
Yes, we get a wonderful sense of, oh, we're just passing through their town again. We should drop in on them. Did they, in some ways, come and knock on your imaginary door and say, it's us, you need to write about us again?
Absolutely. Because I gave them so many of the details of our life in this particular story, I disguised them by making them a little younger. They're almost 90 and I'm past 90. So that was not much of a disguise, but there it is.
And as you say, the last story, The Great Escape, was written in the wake of you and your husband both contracting COVID in March 2020. And your husband didn't come out of hospital. You did. Was there a sense of catharsis in writing the story?
Yeah, there really was. It was cathartic. It was painful and cathartic at the same time. The problem of that type of grieving is that you were deprived of all the usual rituals of mourning. There was no funeral. There were no goodbyes. There was no bedside solace. There was no connection with family, you know, real connection with family, holding one another and being together afterward. So it was very bizarre. And I found that writing it became a way of mourning and also of acceptance. When it was on the page, it became truer. It was surreal before then, and then it became real.
And I've also read that you've said it would have been harder not to have written the story than to write it. Did you feel like you were in some kind of parallel universe and your only way of writing about these real life experiences was to fictionalize it then?
Yes, because again, it was protecting our privacy in a way, but wanting to tell the truth. So I think of it as a truth wrapped in a lie. I did feel a desire to tell exactly what happened to us. But as I said, I assigned it to Paulette and Howard, these characters who I knew well, but who weren't really us. And it felt comfortable giving it to them and comforting to me to write about it and having written about it.
Now, I understand that your daughter Meg, who is also a very successful novelist, was instrumental in getting this collection published.
Yeah, absolutely she was. When I was still in hospital, she was rereading my old short stories for some reason. And she called me after I came home and said she thought it would be a good idea for me to collect them. And I still felt too ill and also too sad about my husband to even think about it. I just couldn't deal with it. And I didn't want to do it for quite a while. But then I began to think that I needed to do something besides grieve, and that I also needed something to look forward to, that even at 91 or 90, which I was then, you need something to look forward to.
The collection has also been recorded as a terrific audiobook narrated by Hilary Huber. Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
Well, my husband and I used to have a little house in the countryside that we drove to every weekend. And it was about a 3 to 4 hour drive each way. And we didn't have audiobooks in those days, but we did have books on tape. And you'd get a box set of maybe a dozen tapes that would be one novel. And I remember two in particular that I loved. One was Derek Jacobi narrating Fathers and Sons, Turgenev's novel. And what was wonderful about it was that he acted out each part. It was as if we were at the performance. And the other one was Dorothy Sayre's Murder Must Advertise. And I don't remember who the narrator was, but we just loved both of them. And it made the ride go by very quickly.
Well, here we've got a clip of Hilary Huber narrating Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket.
What men must learn is that there are some women in this world who are never satisfied, who move through their homes with the restlessness of day workers. Even their blood seems restless, rising and falling so that they are alternately pale or flushed, and suffer from dizzy spells and capricious moods. I am one of these women. Sometimes Howard will ask, "What's the matter with you?" or "What do you want?" But he knows that these are only mind mutterings. I want nothing. I want everything. I am given to looking through windows like a sentinel, fumbling through the mail as if for secret messages, picking up the telephone with renewed expectancy. Hello? Hello? But it is always someone I know.
Hilary Huber, narrating Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket, written by my guest, Hilma Wulitzer.
As we can hear there, you have a wonderful ability to write arresting and very funny opening lines. Do those lines just come to you and act as the springboard for your stories?
They definitely do. At the risk of sounding like Joan of Arc, I do hear a voice in my head, and it's usually a first-person voice saying a sentence. This does not necessarily mean I'm going to follow through. Sometimes I don't, and sometimes I do. And it's always a little nervous business because I can't be sure that I'm going to have a story. I don't outline any of my stories or my books. I'm curious about what happens next, and I take the chance of just writing and seeing what happens next. And I remember that Joseph Heller had a book called Something Happened, and I always lived in fear that I would have a book called Nothing Happened.
As we can hear, you have a super sense of humor, and that, I think, is what makes your stories so poignant and moving when you turn on a sixpence and move from a joke to the sadness that we all feel for people that we have lost or for dreams that have not come true. And that's something that is very much at the heart of Paulette.
Yes, it's sort of my alter ego. I do think that humor, finding something funny or absurd, is a saving grace, not only in fiction, but in life. And I grew up during the Great Depression, and I remember my father was out of work, and then World War II began, and yet I remember a great deal of laughter in the household. And that was contagious.
I know that you have also taught creative writing over the years to many people, and you really value writers having their work reviewed by their peers, don't you?
I do. If you write a story and you show it to your mother's going to love it because she's your mother. If you show it to your husband, he feels that if he doesn't like it, he may never get to sleep that night because you're going to query him all night long. What didn't you like about it? What did you like about it? Did you like it a little bit or a lot? And I think that you need dispassionate readings. I think you need people who don't have any agenda. And that's a little hard to do. Sometimes in workshops, there is some competition. The first workshop I ever took when I was middle-aged was with Anatole Breuard, who later became a daily book reviewer for the New York Times. And he had me read my story aloud in the first workshop. And I was terrified. And he also asked me to spit out my gum first, which was very humiliating. And I read the story very quickly without any affect and then collapsed into my seat. And he asked someone to comment, and this man said it was the most boring thing he had ever heard. And I was so devastated. I felt I was just going to go home and be a housewife forever. I was not going to become a writer. But Anatole, first of all, he passed me a note which said the story is fine, see me later. And then he told my critic that he was certainly entitled to dislike the story, but he had an obligation to tell me why and how he thought I might make it better. So in that moment, I learned something about teaching and about revision. And after class, Anatole put me into an advanced group. And when I went to that group, I read my story aloud again, and they didn't like it either. But they gave me constructive criticism, and that made all the difference. And I do value the criticism, the responses of other writers I respect, starting with my daughter, Meg. She and I do exchange first drafts of our work.
Are you working on anything at the moment? Can we expect another story about Pauly? I'd certainly like to know how things turn out for her.
Me too. Exactly. And I'm thinking about it. I haven't written anything down yet, but I'm thinking about what happens. I happen to be living independently, but I do worry at my age that I will lose that independence. And on the next street, there's a high rise going up for senior citizens. And I dread the thought of losing the apartment I'm used to, the home I'm used to, and the independence I'm used to. And I'm thinking that Pauly might have the same feelings. And I wonder what happens if her children urge her to try going into assisted living and how that would turn out. I don't know how it would turn out, but I'm curious about it.
Well, I'm certain that your conundrum will turn into another wonderful piece of fiction. But for the moment, Hilma Wolitzer, I'm glad to hear that you have physically recovered from COVID. And thank you so much for coming onto the show and sharing some insights into Today, A Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket.
Thank you.
Today, A Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket is out now in print, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books. And Hilma will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, blind author and journalist Robert Kingjet leads us into a world of rogue screen readers and fantasy braille through his collection of short stories, Artificial Divide. But first, earlier we heard Hilma Wolitzer mention how much she used to enjoy listening to Derek Jacobi's narration of Fathers and Sons by Ivan Turgenev. It's just one of hundreds of books that Sir Derek has narrated in a long and distinguished career, some of which we discussed when he kindly invited me over to his home a couple of years ago. Sir Derek Jacobi is one of the outstanding actors of his generation, a star of stage, screen and audiobooks. He's recently celebrated his 80th birthday and, although he's still as busy as ever, he invited me over to chat about his glittering career. We began by talking about the part that brought him into millions of people's living rooms, the lead role in the BBC's 1976 adaptation of I, Claudius.
When Claudius came along, I'd been an actor for 16 years by then. I started in 1960 at the Birmingham Rep. And when Claudius came along, I'd had over 7 years at the National Theatre with Sir Lawrence. But Claudius got me kind of pumped into people's sitting rooms over the course of 6 months. And so my doting parents could actually talk to the neighbours about me, and the neighbours would know who I was. Because up until then, they thought the National Theatre was like the National Coal Board or something, you know. So Claudius, in for my career, was a huge leap forward for me.
It was a fantastic role. I mean, he was in virtually every scene and one of the great schemers in political history.
One of the great schemers and one of the great survivors. Nobody thought he was worth any kind of notice. He was a very educated man. He was a very wily man, because he had to be. But he was very clever at it, and nobody really realised what a canny old man this was. They only saw the outward things. They saw the twitch and they heard the stammer and they saw the limp and, you know, and thought that then he really wasn't worth bothering about. But I didn't record the books of I, Claudius and Claudius the God until many years later. I don't think I'd done any audio recordings up until and including the recording of the television of I, Claudius, yeah.
Did you approach narrating the audiobooks in a very different way to acting the part?
In a sense, yes. I enjoy the audiobooks. You don't have to look your best for a start. You can do it in your pyjamas with a cup of coffee beside you, you know. But it is fascinating because I've always been very interested in the voice. I love doing radio because you have nothing else. They can't see you. They can only hear you. And so everything has to come vocally. The characters have to come alive through your voice. The scene setting has to be through your voice. And that is fascinating. And if you can... It's not easy. And sometimes I get it terribly wrong. There was one time, I won't tell you the author, he's very well known, but I'd been sent this particular book, it was fiction, to read, and it was so boring. I got about a third of the way through and thought, no, I'll wing it, I'll wing the rest. And I got to the studio and we were recording it, and we got quite a long way through it. And we suddenly realised that one of the characters was American. And I hadn't been doing an American accent. But what saved me was the producer had also been bored stiff and had failed to do his homework. So we were both caught out because he hadn't realised either that this particular female character was American. But I survived.
I know many narrators mark up the book with different coloured pens for different characters and make notes in the flyleaf as to always sounds angry or has a very laconic voice. Do you do the same?
Not always, and that is also one of the jobs for the producer, because if you do go wrong and you miss something, the producer is there to say, put you on the right track, you know. No, I'm not a marker of books and a taker of notes. I also have, I was about to say a gift, it's not a gift, it's a knack of being able to sight read. I can read, for instance, I start a sentence and I don't know where the sentence is going, but I can, if I see halfway through the sentence that it's not going where I thought it was going, I am able to change inflection and tone to suggest that I knew all along what the sentence was going to end up as. It is a knack. It is a trick. But then all acting really comes into the category of knack or trick. It can be called a craft, it can be called a skill, it can be called an art, and it is all those things, but it's also trickery.
You've read a very large number of audiobooks, many, many different authors, from Tolkien to Michael Morpurgo to Arthur Conan Doyle. Does that knack work with all authors, or are there some who trip you up from time to time?
It works for most authors. It works for 90%, yes, yes. Because sometimes, you know, you are sent a book to read. And you really, and then they say, we need you next week. Well, you haven't got time sometimes to read the whole book. You kind of get a précis of what it's about and rely on the producer to fill you in. And also this knack that I'm talking about, the sight reading, which comes in very useful. But yes, you're right. Different authors present different problems. And but they're not always problems. They're wonderful things. I am very... I get very emotional when I'm reading, and I tend to cry a lot, particularly if it's a very moving or upsetting piece. Certainly if it's about an animal who's dying, we will take hours in the studio because I can't cope, and I cry, and of course you can hear it. But I try not, in that sense, to get so involved that it harms the recording. You know, it's not about me getting upset. It's about the story and the people I'm trying to be.
One of the more recent books that I've listened to that you narrated was The House of Silk by Anthony Horowitz, yeah. The continuation of the Sherlock Holmes series. And actually, I picked up on your anger at the end of that. It was a very moving book. It was also a great mystery. I associate you now with the Sherlock Holmes series because you've read so many of them, yeah. And with the continuation. Are they books that you particularly enjoy?
Oh, very much. Very much. I love a good mystery. They're well written. They're, for a reader, they're beautifully written. They're very easily written, you know. The lack of being able to switch mid-sentence is... you're very much accommodated by Conan Doyle to do that. No, I think all the stories are great, and all the characters are wonderful. And no, I enjoy that very much, very much. I think I've done most of the short stories, and it's lovely. We did them all, I remember, down in a wonderful studio down in Bath. So I'm down there for two or three days. And two or three days in Bath reading a book is... And getting paid for it, it's quite a good way to earn a living, really.
Are there any other authors who you relish getting the job to narrate?
There's not one particular author that I would relish. I love the variety. There is one author that I dread, and I've recently recorded one of his novels. It's a gentleman called Charles Dickens. And I've just recently finished 1,000 pages of Martin Chuzzlewit. Gosh, it took about 12 days to do this. It seemed endless. They sent me Dombey and Son, and I was the third of the way through that, but I can't do this. Life's too short. So I said, please, I don't want to do Dombey. Can you think of another one? Hoping that they choose something like Tale of Two Cities. They came back with Martin Chuzzlewit, which is a book I didn't know. And I said, yes, OK, we'll do Martin Chuzzlewit. It's long. It's over 1,000 pages. So we started, and I'd forgotten those Dickensian sentences. And there, indeed, you need your wits about you because they are so long and there are so many parentheses that you start a sentence, you have no idea when it's going to end. And you have to work your way through it like a minefield. But what he is very good at is dialogue. And when you get to the scenes of dialogue between the characters, you emit a sigh of such relief that all the descriptive passages are silent for a moment, and that I find difficult. Yes, it's low on the job satisfaction scale. It's an effort, and I'd rather it not be an effort. But what you remember at the end of the session is, oh, thank God it's over.
And at the other end of the scale, if I could offer you any book to narrate that you haven't already narrated, is there one that you would kill for?
There was one book that I longed to record, and it did eventually come my way. It was a book called Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay, which is all about Richard III, a policeman in hospital. His hospital bed is given, sent a card, and it's the picture, the famous picture of Richard III. And he does this big detective job from his bed. I loved that book, and eventually I was asked to do it.
And did you enjoy recording your own autobiography, as luck would have it, which is in the RNIB library?
No, I didn't. No, because I hadn't written it. I mean, it was ghostwritten, but I spent a lot of time with Gary O'Connor, who did write it. We were at university together many, many years ago, and we met up quite by chance. And we were having a drink in a pub, and he said, "Have you ever thought of writing your autobiography?" And I said, no, I can't write. I prefer to read other people's. And he said, "Well, I've done a lot of biographies, particularly theatrical biographies. Would you like me to do it? It would mean, you know, we just talk and chat." And over the next 2 years, we talked and chatted. But I am afraid I displayed my initial lack of interest in it. So he would write, I would talk, and he'd go away, and then he'd come back and he'd send me proofs, and I'd flick through the proofs, not really with any great forensic interest. So when it was eventually published, there were some errors. There were some omissions, bad omissions. So when I was asked to read it, as I read it, I kept coming across, I'd forgotten he'd said that, or I'd missed that bit. And so it wasn't a totally pleasurable experience, but it was something that sort of had to be done, I'm afraid. Oh, dear.
And do you listen to audiobooks for pleasure yourself?
Occasionally. Occasionally in the car or something. But no, I love reading.
But you must be delighted that you are enabling so many people with a print disability to be able to enjoy the same books that you enjoy.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. It's wonderful to be able to do that. And I also narrate a thing called Living Paintings, which are paintings that are done in a format that is raised so that you can follow the pictures with your fingertips while I am telling you what you're touching and who it is or the colour of it. And it's called Living Paintings, and I've done quite a few of those, and I love doing those, and they've been a big success.
Well, Derek Jacobi, thank you so much for opening my eyes to so much great literature over the years, and may you carry on narrating many, many more books in the future.
I will second that. I would love to carry on, because I do enjoy it, and it's wonderful that it helps others and entertains others, you know, and it's just a lovely part of being an actor.
It was all a ghastly mistake. The state of the world at that time was such that no one thought of having a family. Hitler was already advancing fast, and the world was on the brink of war. When I was born in East London on the 22nd of October 1938, this was in our front room in Leytonstone. My mum, Daisy, struggled in labour for 40 long hours to give birth. 40 hours. Has anyone ever taken so long to be born? It must be a record. Mum was completely worn out, and when at last I'd been delivered, she sank back and groaned, "Never again."
For a full list of titles narrated by Derek Jacobi, including his memoir, As Luck Would Have It, My Seven Ages, visit the library at rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Are you living with sight loss? RNIB's free, informal, community-based courses and phone groups provide information, advice, support and practical solutions for people with sight loss and those close to them. We'll help you adjust to your sight condition, increase your independence and boost your confidence. Come and share experiences with others in a similar situation and find out about services available to you. We offer a range of courses, 4 days, 2 days, 1 day specialist days, and continuous phone groups. To find out about courses in your area, email us on lwslenquiries@rnib.org.uk or phone us on 0300 123 3933 or visit our website rnib.org.uk/living with sight loss.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Hilma Wulitzer to share the books of her life, Robert Kingjet is a blind American author and journalist. He's just published Artificial Divide, an anthology of writing by blind and visually impaired authors, telling their stories in their own voices. He joined me from his home in Chicago to tell me more about the collection and his own writing. Robert, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
Artificial Divide is, as I say, a collection of fiction by blind authors. Can you introduce me to the collection?
Yes, sure. So Artificial Divide is a multi-genre anthology, which comprises a compilation of short fictional stories by blind and visually impaired authors, ranging genres from contemporary to science fiction to fantasy, with visually impaired protagonists.
So that really puts visually impaired characters in the driving seat of these stories.
Yes, because I was noticing a trend in publishing, and I wanted to kind of make that trend not cool, which was to limit disabled authors and disabled writers to a certain number of books that we're allowed to have published. For example, a traditional publisher might not publish your book, even though it's very well written and everybody liked it, because the publisher might say, well, we've already got a disabled author. Like, why do we need you? So I saw that trend happening and I said, oh no, this is horrifying. So let me try to publish an anthology that showcases the diversity of visual impairment to showcase that, hey, there's more than one disabled author.
And as you say, there is a very wide range of genre fiction in this anthology. We have fantasy, we have quite hard-hitting observational drama. Do you have a particular favourite? I must say I rather liked the story about the rogue screen reader.
Yes, that one is my favourite as well. It is called Inspiration Porn Star. That one is written by Dr. M. Leona Godin, and it blew my mind. It's about a blind woman who makes a living performing the comedy circuit. And she's definitely not one of your stereotypical blind women that's portrayed in media today, such as the inspirational character and things like that. She's really a personality of her own. And the crux of the story is that rather than learning Braille, she uses text to speech to read her lines on stage. And so one day she kind of fumbles her lines and the screen reader picks up and it starts to say really empowering lines, you know, about disability and about blindness. And so she has a choice to follow this rogue screen reader or to just ignore it and continue to be a crass representation of blindness. It's just a really well-told, provocative story that just had me hooked from the beginning.
And I think that's the thing that really unifies this collection of stories. It portrays blind people as just a normal part of society. We have characters who are thriving. We have characters who are struggling. We have characters who want to take revenge on other people, just like every other person in the world. We don't have to be inspirational. We don't have to be stricken victims, and we don't have to be superpowered. We are just normal people. And I'm assuming that that was what really powered you to collect this anthology of stories.
Yes, yes. Because whenever I do see fictional disabled characters, which is not a lot of time, there needs to be more of them, point blank. But they seem to sort of fall into a common trope of trying to represent the whole community, or maybe they're not, and for whatever reason, though, the publisher has framed them in such a way where they are trying to speak for the community, except these characters are usually written by people without disabilities, and they are well-intentioned, but the authenticity of the character really wanes because they haven't grasped the nuance of what it's like living in this world of disability. And so when I set out to create this collection, that's one of the things I really, really wanted to tackle, to showcase a wide array of disabled characters. Some of them you will hate, some you will love, some of them are really aggressive, and some are not. That's the point, to showcase to the reader that, hey, we're not all just this massive blob of people. We do have differences.
Absolutely. I believe that you were born with retinopathy of prematurity. I have retinitis pigmentosa. Our experiences are not the same. And it's about creating the understanding that blindness covers a wide gamut of conditions and lived experiences.
Yeah, exactly. And what I see in publishing a lot is that publishing will publish a book by a blind author. And in the marketing material, you kind of have the sense like, this is the only blind person living today. And it's very jarring, and it's not exactly accurate either. So, so that what I'm trying to do is make publishers realize that you can have more than one disabled author. We do exist, and we have a multitude of stories to tell that I'm pretty sure are more unique and more entertaining and more authentic than your non-disabled authors.
And how did you go about collecting the stories for the anthology?
We put out a general blind and visually impaired calls for submissions, and we got a wide range of submissions from the UK, from Canada, from Nigeria, and quite a bit of the African diaspora. We did have a grant that helped us to pay the writers. The grant came from Canada, and one of their criteria was that 70% of the anthology had to be Canadian authors. So that made the selection process extremely hard because there were so many great stories that came in from the UK and from South Africa and Japan and other countries. So that was a challenge, but it was very, very rewarding. I would not trade it for the world because I got to meet so many blind and visually impaired authors that I didn't even know existed.
And I know that you are a published author yourself and that writing is particularly important to you. Tell us about your book, Off the Grid.
Yes. So it is a book that I wrote in the early 2010s. It is a book about me trying a social experiment for 1 month to try to not use any internet for 1 month and to chronicle the journey.
What particular challenges did you come across back in 2013 when you were living as a blind person off the grid?
One of the most obvious was access to information. There were a lot of cases where I really wanted to know a piece of information or context to a certain conversation, and I could not look up the bits of information. What was really striking, though, for me was that people who have the internet and who can use it freely without any sort of restrictions, they seem to be in this sort of arena of privilege. And it's morphed into, if you can access the internet reliably, then you are more privileged than someone who cannot due to economic factors or things like that. For example, there's a chapter in the book about banking without the internet. One of my friends wanted me to send them money. He could just log on and press a few things, and then money would be transferred to him. But I had to go down and had to do all this extra verification just to send him money. Not only that, I had to endure a lot of disability tax, as I call it, where I had to go to the local branch hoping that the ATM talked. I had to endure things like getting a headset for the talking ATM to discover that it was not maintained, so the text to speech did not work for me because I had a broken headset and things like that. So it just really opened up my eyes to how society views the internet. And I think that there's a lot of things in the book that we should really take into consideration, especially as the internet evolves and grows.
Indeed. And my screen reader, when I accessed the book over the internet, described the cover that the book has got. Can you describe it for the listeners, please?
Yes, sure. So the cover is a computer keyboard, and it has the tip of a white cane tapping out keys on the keyboard.
Now, for listeners who would like to get hold of both Artificial Divide and Off the Grid, where can they find more information about them and download them?
So the easiest way to get them is through my website, which is blindjournalist.wordpress.com.
Robert Kinjet, thank you so much for introducing us to both your books and for your very thoughtful and insightful comments about how blind writers don't necessarily need to present themselves as role models to a sighted world, and for demonstrating the breadth of genres that blind and partially sighted authors can be experts in.
Thank you for having me.
Now it's back to Hilma Wulitzer for the books of her life.
Hilma, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, it was a book about a doll called Hitty, Her First 100 Years. It was written by Rachel Field, and I believe it was published in 1929, the year before I was born. And I must have been mesmerized by it because I plagiarized it a few years later when I was about 8 or 9. I wrote my first novel about a woman who lives for 100 years. And unfortunately, I no longer have a copy of that novel. So I can't see how closely I plagiarized it, but I'm sure that was the inspiration, the springboard for it.
Unfortunately, Hitty, Her First 100 Years, by Rachel Field, isn't available in audio. But here's a clip that we found online, narrated by Ms. G.
She was almost 8 years old, and I had been measured and made especially for her. The peddler who had carved me held me between his thumb and forefinger, turning me around in the firelight so my paint would dry. I was just the right size, with arms and legs that moved on pegs, and hair painted hazelnut brown. My first night in the world, I was left on the mantelpiece. Shadows from the embers danced on the walls, mice scampered up and down the wainscoting, and pine branches tapped on the window panes.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, I like reading poetry very much. I'm particularly fond of Elizabeth Bishop and of Philip Larkin, that misanthropic person and wonderful poet. I've memorized a couple of his poems. I also like to reread the short stories of Grace Paley, Alice Munro, Chekhov. These are wonderful books to read and reread.
And if you had to choose just one?
I probably would choose, oh my goodness, it's a toss-up between Elizabeth Bishop and Philip Larkin. I have their collected poems in 2 volumes, and I also like her prose as well. She was very funny and very insightful, but I think probably the Larkin.
The differently dressed servants with tiny rooms in huge houses, the dust behind limousines. Never such innocence, never before or since, has changed itself to past without a word. The men leaving the gardens tidy. The thousands of marriages lasting a little while longer. Never such innocence again.
A wide selection of poetry and prose by Philip Larkin is available in Braille and audio from the RNIB Library, including The Sunday Sessions, a selection of 26 of his best-known poems narrated by Philip Larkin himself.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, definitely. It's Jenny Diski's Why Didn't You Just Do What You Were Told? A marvelous collection of essays that were published posthumously, unfortunately. She was brutally funny, honest, really smart, and the essays just sparkle. And she's the sort of writer I wish I knew so I could continue having this conversation with her. Reading a writer is sort of like having a conversation, a one-sided conversation, it's true, but I wish I had known her. That's how important her work is to me.
Her first piece for the LRB was also about exes. Moving day. My ex-living lover will come this afternoon to move his things out. Her daughter has gone to Ireland with her father, the ex-husband, where she'll do rural things that Jenny, born and raised in the Tottenham Court Road, knows nothing about. The kitten is ill and at the vet's. She will have the flat to herself. It is a kind of heaven. This is what I was made for. It is doing nothing. A fraud is being perpetrated. Writing is not work. It's doing nothing. It's not a fraud. Doing nothing is what I have to do to live. Or doing writing is what I have to do nothing. Doing nothing is what I have to do to write. Or writing is what I have to do to be my melancholy self and be alone.
Why Didn't You Just Do What You Were Told by Jenny Diski and narrated by Charlotte Randall and Chloe Diski is available commercially.
Hilma Wulitzer, thank you so much for being in conversation with me today on Read On, and I look forward to inviting you back onto the show in years to come.
Oh, thank you very much, Red.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sale, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.